Hello and welcome to the One Center podcast, where we talk about shamanism from the post-tribal perspective, its place in the world, and how it can be in service to our overall health and all-body wellness. In this episode, Ken and I get into shamanic journeying, beginning to map out what the territory of the three worlds, or what the spirit realm, appears as. Thank you for listening.
The three worlds is specifically the way that many traditional shamanic cultures talk about the spirit realm. Okay, we've talked before about how in shamanism, whether you look at a traditional shamanic practice in Siberia or Mongolia, or a shaman here in the West who's actually doing shamanism, they have to be able to engage with, connect with, and communicate with spirits. And in order to do that, you have to be able to move into that altered state of consciousness that we call trance state. And you have to be able to enter the spirit realm. And when we're entering the spirit realm, we tend to map the spirit realm as having three worlds. Okay, and that varies, but let's keep it really simple for us, okay? We're talking about one upper realm, one middle realm, and one lower realm. And in the most basic sense, we in the West, or we in this post-tribal shamanic practice, look at the middle world as a reflection of the here and now. Our everyday
life. So this is like the spirit realm of just like being out in the world. Sort of reflects the world that we're already in.
Exactly. And this would be very helpful for doing work with the spirits of your natural world. So for instance, if I want to connect in with the spirit of my house or my land or my garden, right? I will go into I'll talk about this in a little bit. I'll go into shamanic body, go into a trance state, move into shamanic state, and move into middle world, and then move out of that area right around the world tree, which we'll talk about in a moment, and out into the middle world, which is the spirit world reflection, or the same thing as our ordinary world. So when I come out of that, I see my house here, but okay, I also feel the spirit more profoundly, more evocatively than I might in my ordinary state of consciousness, right?
Yeah, that was going to be my next question. What would be the benefit of engaging with the spirit in the middle world as opposed to just, I don't know, speaking to it from where you already are?
Right. And you can do that.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it's more effective to do it in that way. So for instance, if I want to make a deal with the nature spirits that inhabit my garden, I can go out back in a shamanic body, call to them, leave gifts for them, and say, hi, first of all, I want to honor you. I want to acknowledge you. I want to make offerings to you. I want to begin to build up an ongoing relationship between myself and all of you. But in order to do that, I need you to keep a lookout on my house, make sure that my fence doesn't go dry and get infested by bugs, whatever.
Sure. A deal. Whatever the thing is, yeah.
Yeah, and then you have to keep your end of the bargain.
Right.
So your end of the bargain is, I'm gonna come out and pour milk and honey over this stone, or put a dish of water on the spirit house once a month. I have to do that.
All relationships require maintenance, your physical friends, right, and your spiritual friends.
Absolutely. So there's the middle world. And we're going to get into this a lot more as we go on. But
absolutely. So
the lower world is where we find the larger spirits, the big spirits, the great spirits. So
the ones that endure. Yeah.
Well, it's not even so much the ones that endure, because a lot of the tiny spirits endure a lot longer than we do. They've been around for what we would consider thousands of years, and they're still here.
Okay.
Okay. So when I say greater spirits, I'm talking about ones that are further along the branch of their kin, shall we say. So for instance, it's one thing for me to have a relationship with the plant in my backyard, right? Mm-hmm. But that plant in my backyard only has so much consciousness. Now,
right.
I want to have a deep medicine relationship. Say my plant in my backyard is a yarrow plant, and I want to use yarrow medicinally for myself, for my family, for clients, right? I will need to go into shamanic body, go into the shamanic realm, go into the world tree, and go down the world tree into the lower world, and then go journey, you know, use my drum spirit to help me journey into the place where that spirit, the overall, the greater yarrow spirit dwells. Okay, and there I can make a similar kind of connection and contract, if you will, with that being.
Yes.
Another thing that they have in the underworld, which is also extremely important, is it is where we can often find our ancestral soul. Now, this is a little confusing.
Because I imagine it's a little confusing and maybe a little controversial, depending on the paradigm you walked out of, because a lot of folks associate the underworld with being a hell realm, which is not the same thing. This is not what we're talking about, but there is that association.
Right. Brought about by the Christians for the most part. So where I was thinking that it was confusing, though, too, is that we all carry our souls, our ancestral souls with us. Our ancestral soul is right with us. It is overlapping our physical body. It is overlapping our vital soul, which inhabits our physical body. It is overlapping the celestial soul, which kind of hangs out there with us. And so why is it that we go into the underworld to engage with the ancestral soul? It's difficult for most of us to turn around and feel our father's spirit right there behind our right shoulder, our mother's spirit right there behind our left shoulder, and all the ones who stand behind them so present. It's difficult to step aside and connect with them because, okay, and this is where that is true. I would say it a little bit differently, but when we're looking at all of our ancestors from where we are in our vital soul, in our ordinary self, right? It's difficult for us to separate enough to be able to be in conversation with them. Does that make sense?
Yes.
So when we go into the, when we go into shamanic body and go down the world tree and enter the lower world, and then follow the drum spirit to the house of the ancestors, we have the opportunity to engage with the ancestors. We're engaging not only with the, you know, the soup, the greater ancestral spirit that is all of your ancestors and you and all of your kids, right?
Yep.
Also, we're engaging with those individuals within the soup, you know, the chunks of the soup, who still have an independent awareness. They're still conscious. They still have a sense of identity separate sure. from the soup, right?
Yeah.
And for yeah. some families, this only lasts 2, 3, 4 generations. In fact, here in the West, that's very common. It's actually very rare working with clients to have somebody here in the West who has been around in that state until their great-great-grandparent, great-great-grandchildren are born. Mm-hmm.
Right? Right.
And in traditional cultures, you'll see ancestors live within that, live is a relative term, but remain identifiable within that space, sometimes 5, 6, 7, sometimes 8 generations. And then something interesting happens, something even more interesting, right? And that is that in some very rare cases, a particular ancestor was powerful enough during their lifetime and continues to have such a powerful, meaningful impact on their descendants.
Yeah.
They have such a profound impact on their descendants that they change, they transform, they become greater ancestors. We might actually say this is where the, in Ahuba, in the African traditions, mm-hmm. North Africa and West Africa, you have ancestors that are so old that all you have is their, the name that we know them by now.
Yeah.
And we don't remember who they were the background of, but so like Alegba.
The Orisha.
All the Orishas, exactly. Okay. Yeah. This is how voles arise. Okay. And so that doesn't happen very often here in the West. In fact,
I could not name. I've been working with my ancestors for decades now, and I could not name one past my great grandparents.
Yeah.
They're soup now.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And I've got some going back like 6 generations, but if you tap me on the shoulder and ask for their name, I'd be like, well, let me think about that. I'll get back to you. Okay, so there we have the lower realm. Let's talk briefly about the upper realm, okay? The upper realm, if the lower realm is where our ancestral soul goes, the upper realm is where our celestial soul tends to hang out. So if we want to have a strong correspondence, a strong conversation between our vital soul, the soul of who we are today in this body, mm-hmm. soul that we identify as me, and the soul that has had all those past lives before this and will go on after this one's gone and have other lives, then one of the ways that we can do that is by going into the upper realm and seeking out our celestial soul. Okay?
Yes.
That's one way, one thing we can do in the upper realm. Another thing is that, and for just a moment, I'm going to talk a little bit about what grandfather teaches happens when we die, okay?
Okay. And
it varies, because one of the things grandfather is very clear about is that none of these teachings are for everybody.
Right. It's not a one-size-fits-all. And if there's anything that's inherent to being a human is that there's great diversity. So.
Yes. Yeah, we've got that part down. But we do seem to all have free souls, whether we realize it or not. So a lot of people walking around out there that don't realize that they have these three souls still have these three souls. It's still part of who they are. So what right. happens with most of them when they die is that the vital soul gets left behind and gradually disseminates into the natural world. It just dissolves into the natural environment, right?
Totally normal, totally okay. Yeah.
The ancestral soul and the celestial soul are the ones that meet your ancestors, if your ancestors are there to meet you.
Most people, they are.
Yeah. And they take you into, you know, through what the Tibetans call the bardo. So there's this process that happens after we die, whereby that part of us that knows where we're going goes with the ancestors into the ancestral realm, into the place where the ancestors dwell, the ancestral soul, right? And during that time, most people are not aware. They have what they experience as a series of dreams. Mm-hmm. And during those dream events, they have the opportunity to kind of get through and compensate and get rid of old gunk. Unfortunately, apparently most people don't take this opportunity. Now, what happens in people who have been practicing post-traumatic shamanism or, say, Tibetan Buddhism, right, is that they develop the capacity to, when they die, to take vital soul with them, because the vital soul becomes integrated with the celestial soul or with the ancestral soul. It just becomes integrated with it.
Okay.
We begin to identify with these other things, and that brings about this different perspective. So what happens then is when the ancestors meet us, we step out of the body and go, oh, okay, body dead, let's go. And so the three souls go down into the underworld, and they go through the bardo realm, right?
And right. So when you're saying in the bardo realm, is that like uncoupling? Is that where they start to separate and become?
That generally starts uncoupling, but it doesn't always.
Okay.
Often the uncoupling starts before that. Sometimes it starts after it. But yeah, that could be what's happening there.
Okay.
Basically, you know how they say, all of us are going to die. And as Pema Chodron says, the only thing you take with you is your state of mind.
Yeah.
And that's true. In a very real way, the best thing you can do is work with your state of mind until you are as compassionate and open and connected and loving as possible. And then that is what you take with you into your next lifetime. Well, you know, that's not bad.
A nice clear consciousness doesn't sound so bad.
Right. If you are doing post-traumatic shamanic practices, then you have the opportunity to connect in more with celestial soul, ancestral soul, right? To the extent that you are able to maintain continuity of consciousness. All that means is that when you leave your body, you are still aware that you are you.
Mm-hmm.
Then what happens is when these bardo experiences arise, you have the opportunity to be conscious and realize, oh, this is not actually a dream. My body is dead, and I am now in the bardo realm. Mm-hmm. And I want to be able to have a good awareness of this, and I want to be able to awaken. So I am going to pay attention to what the bardo realm has to tell me. So I'm seeing that this thing is angry. This thing that I'm dreaming is perhaps angry, perhaps scary, perhaps dangerous, right? And so my natural instinct, my traditional trajectory within this bardo state is to fall into fear. Now, because I know that it's a dream, just like if, you know, right now in this lifetime, if you know something is a dream, you can choose a different outcome for the dream. You can choose a different trajectory. So in the bardo, then, you have a choice to say, all right, this is the bardo, and it's presenting me with a long-standing fear that I have of what is approaching here.
Sure, yeah.
And I choose to recognize that it is a vision, that it is a bardo thing going on, and treat it with compassion. So instead of being turned into a sniveling spirit and running from it, I go, oh, I see you. Thank you for this lesson, you know, and you treat it with compassion and love and acceptance. Completely different experience.
Yeah, right? I'm thinking of Rumi's guest house as you're talking about that very last thing, where you just invite the uglies, invite the unwanteds, invite the things that really, I guess, in this lifetime triggered the heck out of you to just have tea with you. All right, exactly. Let's leaning into it as opposed to being averse. And exactly. And while fear is integral to our survival while we're here, there is a point of challenge, even, I guess there's even challenge post-mortem that we can get through.
And it doesn't help much when we get to that and we're still holding on to it. Mm-hmm. So once we realize that, once we get through enough of those experiences and we're still awake, then we arrive in the underrealm, in the underworld. And there we enter the house of the ancestors, the place where our own ancestral soup and individuals dwell. And there we have a real opportunity to look at any remaining lessons that we need to resolve about this lifetime. Mm-hmm. So anything we still feel guilt or remorse about, anything that we feel disconnected from, anything that needs our attention, right? Mm-hmm. And so what happens then is that there is an uncoupling of the ancestral soul from the celestial soul.
Yeah.
So the part of us, and with the vital soul then, the vital soul seems to become part in the ancestral soul and part in the celestial soul. So part of the ancestral, part of the vital soul remains in the ancestral realm as an individual in most cases. Mm-hmm. So you have the sense of who you were in this lifetime is accessible to your those who follow you for however many generations from now. Sure.
Right. Like, it would still be perfectly appropriate to go to the ancestral soul and be like, hi, Grandma, I've missed you.
Right.
To exactly. Address them directly, still as their individual self, even though they're part of this greater thing.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, part of your vital soul, part of who you were in this lifetime, part of Valerie, is now connected with the celestial soul. And in both cases, this seems to be because we tend to identify with those souls. So in this lifetime, the more you identify, say, with your celestial soul, mm-hmm. the more of Valerie will remain with celestial soul when you leave this body.
Okay, yeah.
Okay. So at some point, and there's no timekeeping that I'm aware of, but at some point, the celestial soul, along with whatever vital soul remains connected with it, leaves the underworld, flows up along the world tree, and all the way into the upper world.
Okay.
Okay, now once there, it has a choice. It has a choice because of your state of consciousness. Okay? Most people, when their celestial soul descends back up to the upper world, they have no necessarily conscious awareness that this is happening. And so they simply follow samsara, which is a word in Sanskrit that essentially talks about our habit of being reborn, of being reincarnated
right.
into another physical body, another lifetime.
Right.
So if we have continuity of consciousness, we're up there, and part of us that probably isn't thinking of itself as Valerie so much anymore, but is now thinking of itself as this being, realizes, okay, I have a choice here. I could choose another lifetime. I could also just hang out here for a while and maybe pass on some of these teachings that have, you know, obviously done something for me to some other students. Or I could dissolve into the pure light of consciousness, right? Become part of soul awareness.
Yes.
Now, for some of us who are who have a tendency to work toward becoming bodhisattvas, that last one isn't really a valid choice because we don't want to disappear into nothingness. We do want to come back. We do want to share the teachings. We do want to be helped, right?
Right. So the ascended masters or the bodhisattvas, whatever word you want to use right. for them, those hang out in the celestial realm, and they find and in some way they are able to find students to pass teachings on to.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Well, and there we get to a very important element. And this is something that shows up in Siberian and Mongolian shamanism and now in Western shamanism through grandfather. When I was much younger, when I was in my teens, right? Mid to late, I think it was like 16 or so. I know. Yeah, 15, 16. Anyway, when I was much younger, I was trying to teach myself how to meditate because I was in a lot of pain. I was suffering a lot. I had lost my mother. I had lost my father. I had lost my elder brother. I had lost a best friend, all at different times over the past 14, 15 years. And so I had a lot of unexpressed pain.
That is a lot of loss for such a young person. Yeah.
Yeah. And I had a lot of, you know, I basically had PTSD without realizing it.
Well, sure.
In any case, I was looking for a way to address this. And one of the things that presented itself to me was the opportunity to meditate. And so I was practicing what I could at the time of meditation. And as I did so, I gradually became aware of a sense that there was somebody sitting right beside me, a feeling of an older man who was sitting there. And when I looked over at him, he would kind of, the sense I got was that he would smile at me, that he had love toward me, that he was supporting of me. And what I didn't realize was that this was grandfather. And it was only after decades of working intensely with grandfather for many, 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 many iterations that I realized that he was choosing me to become a shaman, and that this meant something very specific that I needed to go and come to understand.
Right? Yes.
So he's still up in the celestial realm. Now I can sense him. I can engage with him. I can connect with him while I'm down here, mm-hmm. but he's up there. All right. So this is one thing that the spirits can do. This is one of the uses of the upper world. And that is that I was talking about in Siberia and Mongolia, when yeah. a particularly powerful shaman dies, they will sometimes extract that shaman spirit or part of their spirit and put it into a special tree, or in some cases a mountain. They can become a savdak, a mountain spirit, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And then that spirit can become an onglod, a spirit that can choose and initiate a new person, usually in their ancestral lineage, you know, usually a descendant of theirs, into the practice of shamanism. So this is new, as far as I can tell, that this, I have not found that many indications of there being other places where this is being practiced here in the West, but it's very clear to me, okay, grandfather is an active onglod. He chose me for this. He taught me his teachings. He said that his teachings were specifically for people in the West. And here I am passing those on, planting the seed of shamanism in the West.
Yes.
Right? So that is one thing. When people die here in the West now, they can also, if they maintain continuity of consciousness, they can come up to the world, you know, up to the world tree, up to the upper world, and they can choose someone to pass on their teachings to. Right? They become own gods, to follow the Mongolians, or they become teaching spirits that have a profound impact on the people they choose. Now, what happens more frequently than that is the whole idea of the ascended masters, right? Which is a very Western thing.
Okay.
Which is, if you get up there to the upper realm and you still have continuity of consciousness and you remember the teachings that you received that enabled you to maintain continuity of consciousness, then you can be sitting there in the upper realm and you notice when a new student, you know, somebody who is being trained in some kind of teaching that allows them to journey to what we're calling the upper realm, the upper world, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. When they emerge into the upper world, you have the ability to reach out and say, hey, have I got some teachings for you, right? And then, of course, you want to develop a relationship with them.
Yes.
You want to say, I'm willing to teach you if you're willing to make a fetish of me and put it on your altar and make offerings to it. Whatever, you know. So that's the other way. Okay. So the other thing that the upper world is really good for is that the upper world is where the gods and goddesses, for the most part, okay, then nothing is set in stone, all right? So
no, of course there are some that are they're just by their very nature in other yes, places. So,
exactly.
Like Hades doesn't visit Olympus too often.
Right. So. But if they live on Olympus, they're in the upper realm, right?
Yeah.
So for most of the deities that we encounter, we can find them in the upper world, but we have to go to the god realm, which is a separate, distinct realm. And then within the god realm, there are different realms for the different pantheons.
Right. Absolutely. It makes sense.
Okay.
Yeah.
So a lot of fascinating thing there. And this brings me to another point. And this is extremely important, especially for anyone listening who lives in the West. And that is that there is a huge and so important difference between imagination and actual things that are happening, i.e. reality.
Yes. I think that's a really important distinction to make, because there's our physical world that we spend most of our ordinary life in. There is our imagination, which is mostly mentalizations. But there's a third thing here that you're talking right about. There's a third thing that you're pointing at. The spirit realm is not an act of imagination. The spirit realm is in some ways a reflection of the physical world, but it isn't that either. So right. I think that would be great if you could explain how to discern, like, what the heck we're doing here.
Yeah. Right. The basis of discernment. One of the tools that I teach is the ability to move into a state of mind that I call observer mind. Okay, so it's a lot like mindfulness, but it's a part of our brain that is able to observe our thoughts without thinking them, without directly engaging them. Mm-hmm. And so what happens is you hear an observer mind, a thought arises, you observe the thought, and it dissolves. Okay, that in a very, very much in a nutshell, that's what happens. The thinking mind allows us to differentiate between those things which arise from thought and those things which arise from a greater source. So eventually we look deeper, we look to the source of these thoughts, right? And when we do that, we eventually come to a place of emptiness. And then we are able to observe that the emptiness is filled with awareness. And when we observe the awareness and the emptiness, we see that they are connected. They are in union. Now, this whole time, we are in observer mind. We're not thinking about these things. We're simply observing them. If we think about them, we observe the thoughts, and the thought disappears. Yes. But if we observe these things, what we notice is that this union of the awareness and the emptiness does not disappear when observer mind sees it. What this tells us is that this is coming from someplace with a deeper root than our conscious mind. And this is hugely important. Mm-hmm. So when we practice this, as we observe further and further this state of what I like to call, or what grandfather calls, soul awareness, right? This luminous field of awareness that is rooted and in union with that emptiness. The space from which all of our thoughts arise, as we observe it, we can notice that within this space, there is stillness. Nothing is moving here. When we see something moving and we observe it, it dissolves. And so that quality of stillness becomes another thing that is, you know, it's dependable. It's not imaginary.
Right. It allows for a deepener awareness than just your average daily thoughts.
Yeah. Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that ability, that capacity to see the stillness, to observe the stillness, and after the stillness, to observe the silence, to notice that even while somebody's talking, or the cars are going by, or there's something else happening out here in the everyday world, that here within you, there is absolute silence. This is real. This does not fall away when you observe it.
No.
In the same way, there's also spaciousness. And these, you know, you can look at some Tibetan bone practices, Tibetan Buddhist meditative practices, and you'll see the same thing. They call these the pills, the three pills, and three whatever. I forget the exact terminology, but
sorry, I don't know that one.
Being able to bring to mind that stillness, that silence, that spaciousness. These are the three pills. These allow you to deal with the harshness of everyday life.
Yeah, I was going to say that I think this is so critical in a time where everything is so overwhelming everywhere. Flashing lights, ambulance going by, ads shouting at you when you pump your gas at the gas pump. Just everything is just stimulation, stimulation, stimulation. So being able to declutter and get all the chattery chatters that are just taking over all your space. It's so wonderful. Yes. To know that you have, wherever you go, that fixed stillness and silence within you.
Absolutely. And that is something you bring with you then into this awareness, this space of the spirit realm. And this allows you to, when you are in shamanic body, to remember, I still have an observer mind. And in observer mind, I can observe whatever is happening here. I can observe the world tree. And I might notice that the image that I have projected onto the world tree of a glowing 300-year-old oak disappears, falls away. Mm-hmm. And yet what remains is clearly still what we are calling the world tree. Even if it's just a directly felt example of the Axis Mundi, that which connects the one center, which is everywhere, including the upper realm and the lower realm, through the middle realm.
I think so. I think it would also be helpful to point out that while we're traveling around in the spiritual realm, it's a different sensory experience. It's not like reaching out and grabbing your sweater. And it's not like, as you've explained so thoroughly, like not a creative thing in your head, that the visuals, they fall away. But it is a different way of sensing that is sort of like feeling, but it's a different thing that most of us haven't cultivated. So it takes a little time. It takes a little time to be able to perceive from the space in new ways.
Well, and you bring up an extremely important aspect of this, which is that most Westerners have the idea that the experience of shamanism is very visual. Mm-hmm. And this is not usually true. If you happen to be one of those rare people whose brain tends to translate what you're experiencing in the spirit realm into visual images, then you will have a visual experience.
Right.
But if, like myself and most humans, you encounter the world tree, you encounter other spirits, and all you experience is a felt sense of there is someone here, there is something there, you know, I'm moving through here. That is a valid experience. And with practice, that experience becomes more and more repeatable, okay? Mm-hmm. When I look at grandfather, for instance, you know, if I go into the, what I call the shamanic lodge, you know, I go into shamanic body, go into shamanic lodge, and we will talk, you know, in the future about how to move from one world to another, how to move from this state into, I don't think we need to do that right now. But once in there, when I am observing the tree, I'm not seeing something in the ordinary state. I'm sensing something. If I spin around in a circle and then say, okay, which direction is the tree? It's really clear where the tree is, right?
Yes.
Now, if I suddenly see a purple dragon come in and circle around the tree, I'm going to go and say, okay, where is observer mind? I'm going to feel observer mind. And chances are, Mr. Purple Dragon is going to disappear because that's probably a projection of my brain. It is a thought creating an image that I'm then seeing.
Right. Right, because our brains have been thinking our whole lives and it just wants something to do. And sometimes it gets a little carried away with itself.
It is its favorite mechanism. And that's, it's very good at it and no reason. And I will say too, there's nothing wrong with creative visualization. It's just
it's a wonderful tool.
Yeah, it's a powerful, effective tool. It is not shamanic journeying. Okay, that's the only thing I'm saying. I'm not putting creative visualization down. It's simply not this. And it's very important for people to realize that. Because so many people come into shamanic training and feel like, oh, I'm no good at this. I'll never be good at this because I'm not visualizing things.
Mm-hmm.
Well, welcome to the club. So, for instance, you know, when I talk about the, when you go into that state of emptiness, right? When I talk to my friends over in Mongolia, who are shamans, right? The way that they go into shamanic states, you know, into spiritual realm, is that they go into that emptiness.
And right, they dive head first. Yep.
Right. And I have great respect for them. And I'm not interested in doing that. Because I know how dangerous that is. So what you'll find is that the technique, which we'll go over in the future, that grandfather has taught me about how to move into spiritual states, how to move into shamanic realm, how to move into our shamanic body,
mm-hmm.
that technique, I think that any Westerner or Mongolian or Siberian or Tibetan, whatever, could do it because it uses parts of the energetic anatomy that everybody has. And it's why my first workshop is called Opening Inner Doorways, because that's basically it. It's moving through these inner doorways that we open and then move through in order to engage with and become this other state. All right, so we have addressed the difference between real and unreal.
Yeah.
And looked at the process of discernment. All right, so next I want to talk about what do you have on the agenda there?
Well, that was it. I just thought we could come in and talk about the three worlds today, and we've touched on all three, and okay. You have...
One thing that I would say is that what we've looked at today is just a briefest overview of this very dynamic practice, and that it's very important to keep in mind that what we engage here is real, that it has a profound impact on our lives, that it has depth, and that we can tell, we can learn to discern between what is real in these states and what we are creating with our mind.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I think that is so important. And so what we've learned is that, okay, for us in this particular use of post-tribal shamanism, grandfather's teachings pass through me and to my apprentices like you and beyond, we use the idea of the three worlds. We move through the inner doorways into the spirit realm and into a different vehicle for consciousness, which we call shamanic body. In that shamanic body, just as this physical body is the way that I move about in my ordinary state of consciousness, one of the things that we learn in this practice is how to extend our consciousness beyond the realm of our physical body. Most people here in the West are only familiar with the idea of that happening during dreams, right? And so there's going to be a process whereby they learn, oh, there's a way for me to extend way beyond my skin, way beyond this world, and have active engagement with these other worlds. And one point I want to leave you with is that we have all these stories and ideas that we hold on to about shamans. And one of those is that the shaman, when they journey, it's like their physical body just drops away, goes to sleep, and their shamanic body goes into the spirit realm, and that is all they experience. That kind of journeying is actually very rare. In the vast majority of times, of things that I've encountered and that I've seen other people do, the physical body is in a trance state, but it's still active. It might be drumming. Right.
It's relaxed. It's sitting there. It's a way. Right. It's still there though.
Yeah. And really the movement into this other state is a little bit like the idea of extending your consciousness to your left hand and your right hand, and then doing something different, like patting your stomach while you rub your head. You're doing different things with different parts of yourself, but they're still connected. Okay, so even when I am in shamanic body and I am journeying into the underworld to talk to somebody's ancestors, or to talk to one of the greater animal spirits, something like that, there is some part of me that is still back in my physical body. And that part, especially if I'm actively working with a client or a student, is I have to be conscious enough to be functional. And so what I see happen is that consciousness gets bigger. Consciousness grows, expands its ability. Mm-hmm. And there are things that you can do now as an apprentice that you probably looked at 10 years ago and went, how is Ken doing that? I just don't get that. And now it's like, well, of course you do that.
It does take time to develop the senses in order to engage in these ways. I think it's really interesting that we could send out an extension of our consciousness in shamanic body through spirit realm to get information or to engage in practices that have meaningful impact on our daily lives.
And that's a good place to wrap it up for this episode. If you like what you've heard, please subscribe and leave us a review. You can connect with us through email at onecenterpod@gmail.com with any questions or kindly comments. Ken can be found, KennDay, on Insight Timer, Instagram, TikTok, and Facebook if you wanted to follow on the socials. Thanks again for listening, and until next time.